There is this thing. Do you realize?
Our consciousness is affected.
There is this thing on. There is this thing going on. Do you realize?
Our consciousness is affected.
There is this thing going on.
What is called?
The news brought to you live.
Hi, welcome back to Unfit to Print. This is CKUT on 90.3 FM in Montreal. My name is Sean Lathrop.
And I'm Amy Lloyd. Today we broadcast live from the Geogeage, the traditional territory of the Haudenosaunee and the Anishinaabe Nations. The time now is 5:01.
This week's episode focuses on the Sir George Williams affair, the occupation of the ninth floor of the Hull building at Concordia by 200 students, which ended in 1969 on February 11th. News editor Athena Khalid speaks about the affair in an audio essay, which uses audio from the Protests and Pedagogy lecture series. Please read more in the Daily's feature this week. We will also be interviewing Sophia Esterly about last week's Eating Disorder Awareness Week, how it went, and what to expect next year.
And of course, we'll give you an update on local news. Enjoy the rest of our jingle and a little tune.
Thank you. That was Pottery with Hank Williams. The time now is 5:06. Now for our weekly headline roundup.
A new student coalition has formed in Quebec, including students from high school, CEGEP, and universities such as Concordia. This new coalition will be hosting a province-wide climate change strike on the 15th of March. Jimmy Lavitesse, a Concordia student involved in the march, expressed his concerns to CTV News, saying, "What happens when you elect people to represent you and they fail to do so when they're not considering your future?"
The Villeray-Saint-Michel Park Extension Borough Council delayed the vote to grant demolition permits for 891, 893, and 925 Beaumont Avenue last Tuesday, February 5th. No date for the next vote has been set. Preceding the council meeting was a demonstration organized by Comité d'Action de Parc Extension, otherwise known as CAPE, a community organization committing to defend tenant rights within the park extension community. CAPE has been hard at work in recent years preparing themselves for the influx of students associated with a new campus of the Université de Montréal, opening in neighboring Outremont this fall. The protest allowed space for tenants to speak up about their situations. Mary, a mother of four, spoke about her landlord's attempt to evict her multiple times. Another man told the crowd he has been on social housing waitlist for the past 3 years. A third tenant expressed his struggles with cockroaches and unresponsive landlords. As Sasha Dick, one of the organizers of the event, said, "Beaumont right now is the epicenter, the ground zero for gentrification and park extension."
A Mohawk Immersion Elementary School in Kanasadage, Quebec, are planning to launch a new app. The app will be called Kanasadage Mohawk and contains 500 Kanasadage words, ranging from animals, greetings, and numbers. The Mohawk language includes 8 different dialects across Quebec, Ontario, and New York State. Hilda Nicholas, director of the cultural center in which the school partnered with, states that there are only 60 first language speakers left in Kanasadage. She, like other members of the community, hope the app will help preserve this dialect.
In May 2016, the SPVM equipped 78 police officers with body cameras for a period of 7 months. The pilot project, aimed at evaluating the impact of mandatory body cameras on the use of force, ended in April last year. An extensively detailed report of the project was presented to the City of Montreal's Public Security Commission on February 1st. The SPVM was responsible for the deaths of Pierre Corlian in 2017 and Nicholas Gibbs in 2018. Almost a year later, the SPVM's final report advises against the widespread implementation of body cameras within the city's police forces. Mayor Valérie Plante decided against implementing the project. Majiza Philip, whose arm was broken by the SPVM officers in 2014, told CBC that if police knew they were being watched, it would have been different. She went on to say that, "I think one of the reasons that the SPVM doesn't want body cameras is because they don't want to be accountable. We have to hold police accountable. We want police surveillance."
That was our weekly headline roundup. Please stay tuned for an interview with Sophia Esther about the Eating Disorder Awareness Week.
Got an idea for a local or McGill story you'd like to turn into a podcast? Are there unexplored topics or underrepresented voices that you think deserve a platform? CKUT is expanding our digital programming, and we're looking to develop 8 new podcast series. Content can be fictional or fact, and can explore anything from the historical, comedic, musical, scientific, and the investigative. You will outline the content and narrative, and CKUT will support you with the logistics, including equipment, editing, interviewing, and promotion. This is an opportunity to learn all the skills you need to produce your own podcast. Email your pitch to culture@ckut.ca by March 4th. Make sure to include Podcast Proposal 2019 in the subject line. Have your story heard. Thank you.
Welcome back to Unfit to Print. The time now is 5:15. That was Donnie Ahrens, my close friend, with Chip of Fingernails. You're listening to CKUT 90.3 FM in Montreal.
It is also time for our interview with Sophia Esterle, who is a SMU executive at McGill and the lead organizer of the Eating Disorder Awareness Week, which happened last week. I want to include a content warning, as this interview includes topics surrounding eating disorders, bulimia, anorexia, fat phobia, and stigma associated with EDs. Hello, Sophia. Thank you for coming on.
Thank you for having me.
So just to start, how do you think students responded to this Awareness Week?
I think really well. The events had pretty solid attendance for like being events that happened for the first time. And I think that one thing that I was really surprised and like happy about was that it was a conversation going around campus. I had friends who were full fellows and just like random people who would know about the National Eating Disorder Awareness Week. Even if they didn't go to events, it was a conversation that was starting. And I think that's part of the awareness too.
So, from personal experience and academic research, what do you feel is one of the greatest stigmas surrounding eating disorders?
I think it's recognizing what an eating disorder is. One of the huge things is that it's a physical thing, which, like, it does have a physical impact, but an eating disorder is a psychological disorder. So, like, you don't have to look like you have an eating disorder to have an eating disorder. It's about your relationship with food and the way you, like, it's a coping mechanism. So it's the way you cope. It's the way you relate to food. It's the way you see it. It's the way you eat it. And I think that a lot of people don't see that, so they will... Like, at disclosures of eating disorders and when people come out about having eating disorders, a lot of people will either not understand or get really freaked out because of, like, the misconceptions that they have eating disorders, or just, like, say same. Like, if you start talking about the details of your experience, I know at least in my experience, I had a lot of friends who were just like, oh, yeah, RT, like, retweet, which isn't the case. Like, there are a lot of normalized behaviors that can turn into an eating disorder, but the way you relate to food, if you don't have an eating disorder, you just don't really get it. And it's something that's really hard to understand, but I think it's also something that a lot of people will respond by kind of fake relating and not realizing that it's not the same experience.
During the week, do you think there was a lot of fake relating or people just sort of, I guess, lowering the severity of the issues?
I think that through the events, especially since we had like a professional, like a social worker from the Douglas Institute, and I made an effort to have students speak about their own experiences, people really recognize that. I don't know about the like off events conversations. I hope it didn't happen, but I'm hoping that the events and the content that we shared will point out to people, like will kind of make people realize that it's not a retweet kind of feeling.
So speaking on the image of eating disorders, Raquel Richard wrote an article titled Seven Ways the Media's Depiction of Eating Disorders Failed Me as a Woman of Color. In her article, she discusses how the media portrays eating disorders as a white woman problem. How does this portrayal worsen the experiences for people of color, specifically Black and Brown and Indigenous folks who are struggling with eating disorders?
I mean, that's like, I don't belong to any of those identities, so I can't really like relate to what that would be like. But I guess I can imagine that like not having your experience displayed, because like an eating disorder also has a lot about like your has a lot to do with your relationship with your body, and any kind of like discrimination or things from the outside perception of your body and the outside perception of others onto you and kind of assumptions that they'll have very deeply impacts the way you relate to your own body. And that can play a huge part in having an eating disorder and how you cope with it and how you use an eating disorder to cope, but also, yeah, just the way you see yourself and the way you're going to treat your own body. And so I think that, yeah, like not having your experience displayed and not having the conversation about how like people of color or just like having the experience of the white woman doesn't display the experiences of people who don't identify as a woman and people who aren't white. And it gets a lot more complicated. And I think that conversation really needs to be part of the picture.
So kind of continuing on this conversation of misrepresentation, people feel that there's a lot of misleading representations of eating disorders in the media, and they are responsible for promoting this. Why do you think that there is this like limited representation in terms of eating disorders?
I can't give like a full answer to that. I guess it's easier to just kind of have it adhere to like the majority and also just like the assumption, like, because there are so many kind of assumptions and behaviors that are expected of women, especially towards, like, the way they look, it's a lot easier to just be like, oh, this is the experience of an eating disorder, especially since it's a conversation that isn't really started or talked about anywhere. It's definitely, like, having the topic being started is hard enough. I think a lot of people use the easy way out and kind of just start with that. But the conversation does need to go further, because even if you start the conversation, which is great, you need to have a conversation that's accurate and that's representing the voices that won't be heard.
In our previous interview for The Daily, we discussed the preconceived notions surrounding eating disorders. There's an image of eating disorders that consists of thinness. How does this image prevent those struggling with EDs from associating themselves with the eating disorder community?
And that's an issue that also starts with treatment. There's a lot of places that don't accept you based on, like, the BMI that you have. Mm-hmm. And I think that, having that kind of barrier convinces you that you don't have an eating disorder unless you look like you have an eating disorder, which will just make you want to get worse. And I know that in my own experience, like, when I had an eating disorder, it was always, like, I wanted to get worse, and it was part of the disordered, like, part of my mind that just wanted me to get worse and worse so that people would see it and so that it would be a real, like, quote-unquote real eating disorder, which isn't the case. Like, it's the eating disorder starts before you, like, start looking like you have an eating disorder, and the deeper and deeper you get into that, the harder it is to get out of it. So I don't remember the beginning of the question, but
So Mount Sinai, an adolescent health center, released a study stating that transgender college students are 5 times more likely to have an ED than their cis peers. Gay and bisexual men are 3 times more likely to have an ED than straight men. As we've discussed, the LGBT community other marginalized communities, or what are considered to be marginalized communities, are excluded in the mainstream depictions and discussions surrounding disorders, eating disorders. How did you create an exclusive space for queer students during this Awareness Week?
I tried to have as many, like, speakers that that identify with the LGBTQ2+ community as possible, and just have, like, those people also involved in my working group with the organizing. But unfortunately, there weren't that many. I mean, like, I'm gay, and I tried to, like, have that conversation be started, but I can't speak for people who identify as non-binary or trans or, you know, anything other than, like, gay or cis. And so I tried to have that space, and I tried to start those conversations, and I tried to acknowledge, like, even during the discussion panel, I tried to have a couple questions that were just, like, even if people weren't able to answer them, that they were there, and that was a part of the conversation. And I hope that I created spaces where people felt safe enough to, like, talk about their experiences, and there were some people who did talk about it, but I hope that in the next years, the next VP Student Life kind of continues to create a space where people do feel comfortable sharing their experiences, because I think that's part of it. It's acknowledging that it's a space where it's not as easy to talk about it, and making the efforts to turn it into that.
So going back to, you know, that you said that eating disorders were a coping mechanism. So people often assume that eating disorders stem from just fat phobia. In what ways is this misrepresentative in terms of how eating disorders develop? And in what ways does this worsen the experiences for those subjected to fat phobia?
I can't speak really to the experiences of people. Can you repeat the last part of the question?
Oh, in what ways does this worsen experiences for those subjected to fat phobia?
Yeah, I can't, like, I've never been directly subjected to fat phobia, like, from a societal, point of view. And I can't really, like, relate to what that discrimination would be like. But I think that, sorry, I'm forgetting parts of the question.
Oh, the first question just says how people often assume that eating disorders solely stem from fat phobia, and how is that misrepresentative in terms of how people develop eating disorders?
Yeah, okay, so I'll try and answer that part first. I think that goes hand in hand with the depiction of, like, the eating disorders being, of people going through eating disorders as being, like, white, cis, straight women. Mm-hmm. Because, again, like, you'll develop an eating disorder. At least in my, like, experience, it was, like, part of me developing my eating disorder was, having difficulty accepting that I was gay. Mm-hmm. And that was, like, a difference between me and my body and what I wanted, and kind of fighting against it. And that's part of, like, the coping mechanism. It's just, like, not wanting to be in my own body. And I think that, yeah, and with other people who suffer from like discrimination or just not being part of like the privileged norm, it can definitely be a part of it. And that's definitely a misconception that's not really talked about in the conversation around eating disorders. And so, yeah, it's not just fat phobia. It's the way you relate to yourself. And that can be a lot harder when you're not part, when you're not as privileged. Yeah.
I'm just going to jump in here. I just have a question about eating disorders versus disordered eating. I've heard people use those as synonyms, and I've been told like that's not really, you know, correct terminology. I was wondering if you could speak to the difference between those two things, and I'm wondering if Eating Disorder Awareness Week also addressed disordered eating as a part of it.
Yeah, so that was one of the questions that I asked directly the social worker from the Douglas Institute during one of her workshops, and it was talked about in basically every event except the discussion groups, where like it was talked about if people wanted to talk about it. But yeah, it was definitely like I asked the social worker to give her definition, and then I asked the people who had actually gone through eating disorders to give their definition of how it goes between the two. And yeah, so there was a conversation around it, and it was addressed. And I think that maybe it wasn't addressed enough. But there's definitely like a huge part of disordered eating that goes with like fighting against it. And that goes with kind of like with self-care, like thinking that and the misconceptions of eating disorders. It's like saying that self-care is the answer to all your mental illnesses / mental health problems, which, you know, like eating well, it can definitely help with like certain parts of like getting better in terms of mental health and some mental illnesses, but it's also like not something that's always accessible or possible for people. And there is in eating disorder, there is disordered eating. You're not eating like other people, or sometimes you are and sometimes you don't. It depends on what you're going through. But yeah, like I think that I tried to approach it as much as possible, and we did discuss it during the workshops. I don't think that in terms of like the social media and the event page, we discussed it enough. But it's an important conversation to have.
So going back to the topic of fat phobia, you held a workshop titled Unboxing Fat Phobia. And I was just wondering if you could explain the objective behind this and how the discussion went.
So the discussion was pretty good, but it was a very small group. It was the least attended workshop, which was unfortunate. The objective behind it was kind of addressing that part of the conversation too. I don't think people talk about fat phobia that much, and kind of the discrimination that people go through. And it was definitely like I learned a lot, even just like going to the workshop and listening to the presenter speak. So that was really great to hear about. But yeah, I think it was just kind of like talking about it, opening the conversation around it, and kind of just also like being like it's addressing the systemic issues of fat phobia, but it's also addressing the fat phobia itself, which people shouldn't go through and people shouldn't feel. Yeah. And obviously like it's something that our systems and society has created, but I think like acknowledging it in small groups and talking about it and unboxing it is a start, and it's a start that can lead to later conversations afterwards.
So many assume that EDs are a matter of vanity, as we've kind of discussed before with body image and fat phobia, instead of a neurological issue. How did you address this misconception during your awareness week?
Almost every single one of the workshops started with what is an eating disorder, which I think is the best way to address that, because it's just like that shows that it's not a vanity issue. And yeah, so the way we addressed it was like kind of introducing it in every single workshop, trying to have it in the descriptions. We are making, after the Eating Disorder Awareness Week, we're making Humans of McGill posts where people actually talk about their experiences. And I'm making a TVM video as well. And also just like during the discussion panel and during like throughout the conversation that we had at the workshops and the discussion panels, people just talking about their experiences and what it's actually like, I think directly addresses that, because it's a misconception that as soon as you kind of like start the actual conversation on eating disorders, as seen as like you understand that that's not the case.
Yeah, I definitely feel that there's like a narrative out there that's when you express concern in terms of eating disorder, people are like, no, you look great. It's not really the issue.
Yeah.
Jumping in just one more time. I know that the McGill Health Services recently shut down their program that specifically addressed eating disorders. I was wondering, like, if you have any information on this, if you could speak about what the program did offer, sort of its faults and the things, its merits. And then also, like what, if anything, the health services is doing now specifically for students with who are suffering with eating disorders.
I can't elaborate that much on the eating disorder program because I like it was defunded almost immediately when I came to McGill, and I never went through it. But from what I've heard from other people, it was okay. Like, it was a great program for a university to have, and one of the, like, basically the best program I've heard of, like, a university having. And they gave treatment. They had, they had specialized therapists and dietitians, which is, like, huge, and just, like, a program where people could, like, be a part of it. I did hear that the requirements to get in were very hard to. I mean, I think it had only, like, about 70 students, which is great for the 70 students in it, but the people who weren't in it, it's a lot tougher. And it was also throughout my research of it, they used to do events for Eating Disorder Awareness Week, and then that kind of just, like, completely stopped. And they had some pretty great events where they had, like, collabs with Queer McGill and people coming in, and clothing drives for, like, the clothes you won't wear anymore. They had really great events, and it's really a shame that they don't have that. I forgot the second part of your question, though.
Just what's available now in terms of health services and eating disorders? Like, what's available for students? Where can you go on campus to address an eating disorder problem?
So there is, within the McGill Student Services, there are two part-time dietitians on my campus. There's one that goes every 2 weeks once. So there are two dietitians. I think one of them is specialized in eating disorders, and I don't know the exact number of psychologists that are specialized in eating disorder, but it must be one or two. So it's very, very limited resources. There is, like, care offered on campus, but it's just, like, very limited. There are so many resources throughout Montreal, though.
Can you speak to those? Can you?
Yeah, I was going to bring my pamphlet and I forgot. And all of them are listed on the SMU website on the resources for eating disorders. But off the top of my head, there's the Douglas, like, there are a couple institutes. So there's the Douglas Institute, which is, I think, funded, like, it's a public institute, and you need requirements, like, you have to pass through certain requirements to get into it, but they give an inpatient treatment, and then there's BACA that also gives an inpatient treatment, but they give outpatient, there's inpatient, then outpatient, and then, like, supervised meals. So there's, like, the program where you will actually, like, sleep there and get the treatment and have it full time. There's a treatment where you only go during the day. There's a treatment where you go for, like, two supervised meals. There's also treatment where you see someone regularly and you go over there. And then there are a bunch of Quebec organizations. So there's a helpline from ANEB, I think they're called, that gives a helpline, support groups throughout Quebec. So I think there's one in Montreal as well. And they have workshops. So they give a lot of, like, online resources and resources in Montreal if you look for their website. So it's ANEB, and then I forget the name of the big Canada one. But the big Canada one, which I forget the name of, gives, also has a helpline, and they have a lot of resources. They show, like, they have an entire list of resources with, like, the financial details as well.
And where is that available on the SMU's website? Can you just...
Yeah, so I don't remember the exact, like, slash, but it's on the SMU website, and then it's resources, and if you go over the resources button, eating disorders will pull down under mental health.
So lastly, what are your next steps to continue the conversation around eating disorders, specifically McGill students struggling with eating disorders?
So as I mentioned before, we're releasing Humans of McGill posts. Mm-hmm. There's going to be like three or four, I think. I'm creating a video with TVM, where people just talk about their experiences, and we'll try and share that with content warnings, obviously. And then I'm also working with a couple of folks on creating an actual, like, club that would later hopefully become a service, where our ideal, like, later on version of the club would be a club that gives, that has a helpline, provides support groups. There would be an online version where you can, like, chat with people. Everybody would be trained. There'd be a developed training that would be given by professionals to the volunteers. And then there would be developed training by the group itself, that would then have a part of the service that would be dedicated to spreading that to other schools in Montreal, and then, like, further, like, basically expanding as much as they can in each university. These are all off the top of my head, so I don't remember exactly. But it also would be going through, like, to high schools and trying to, like, have that workshop available for groups at McGill and just like smooth sex, hopefully having that like put into the floor fellow training, maybe working with counseling, but basically expanding over that and then them taking on Eating Disorder Awareness Week at some point, and working with SMU, but it, them being like dedicated to it. And yeah, so it would be a lot of like forms of support and then an advocacy branch and an outreach branch. And then I'm also working on a campaign in Quebec. So my student staff just got hired to help me with it. I can't give that many details of it because I'm going to be consulting with her on exactly where we're going. But we'll be working with other student unions, like the provincial organizations, the Minister of Education, to pressure kind of like putting, dedicating a fund towards making more resources for eating disorders, specifically in universities. Yeah.
Well, thank you so much for coming on. And now it's time for a little musical break.
Welcome back to Unfit to Print. The time now is 5:37. That was Friggs with Gemini. Now we have a special report from news editor and former co-host Athena Khalid.
From January 29th to February 11th, 1969, a 13-day occupation on the ninth floor of the Hall Building at Sir George Williams University, now Concordia University, took place. The occupation came after months, if not years, of escalating tensions between the students and the administration. Six students brought a complaint against Perry Anderson for discrimination against black students, i.e. racism, to the administration in April 1968. In the months between April and January, the students tried to get the administration to act, tried to hold Anderson accountable via due process. However, the administration was unresponsive at best. On January 29th, a hearing was taking place. The hearing was deemed illegitimate by the students as they had no representation on the hearing committee. The students took to the floor and called on other students to join them in occupying the ninth floor, where the university's computers were housed. On February 10th, it seemed that an agreement was going to be reached between students and the administration, but the Faculty Association vetoed it at the last minute. On February 11th, Acting Principal D.B. Clark called in the police. The local police arrived at 4 a.m., but left soon thereafter. Students barricaded themselves on the ninth floor and threw various objects out of the windows, as they had been using the value of the computer center as leverage so that the police would not be called in. Somehow, a fire started. The students, barricaded on the ninth floor, barely escaped. All occupiers suggest that the police set the fire. The students escaped the fire into the embrace of the police, who assaulted and brutalized students. 97 were arrested, many were deported, and many suggest that Coralie Hutchison's death was a result of police battery. Today, February 12th, comes a day after the 50th anniversary of the climax, per se, of this series of events. The following audio essay includes the voices of Rodney John, Brenda Dash, and Michelle Serrano. The following audio essay also includes graphic descriptions of police violence.
Someone at the door. I mean, you couldn't just because I was involved in the protest, I could just walk into the computer, the room itself, no pen dukes. So there were lounges and other areas that we had cleaned up or pushed things, some furniture around that we hung out in, but not in the computer room proper. And so our plan was always, if they send the riot police for us, we will all move into the computer room. That was the plan. So we thought that that would be our defense, because they wouldn't want to hurt the computers, which if you're starting banging and swinging around sticks and who knows what, something's going to get hurt here, especially when you've got hundreds of people inside of the space. So that was one of the things that was very, was law, kind of, within the computer center, within the city itself.
It was a very structured environment because there were times a day, I'll remember when we had meetings and people would come and bring facts up. There were set times for meetings and you would ask questions and it was like, like what should we do? It wasn't one person who came in and said, okay, today we're going to bust the door here or there. The physical setup, as was mentioned, we were not in the computer room. In fact, when all hell broke loose, most of us were in the back room, trying to get out. It was also a time that sometimes were very exciting and personal, fantastic discussions about politics, women. It was very stimulating. And other times, it was boring. And you just sat and it was okay.
Taking it out.
And because most people came early in the morning, I used to go to my classes, which weren't that long. And then run back in and out and do your work there. People you do their studies, etc. So it was just a place where I felt I belonged, which was the first time in a long time in my life that I could say that.
It was a sense of community. It was of tremendous amount of energy. It had a life of its own.
Right.
There were six of us. Beyond that, you had concentric circles of different people, different levels of involvement, so that it just developed organically. There was no central organizer. And essentially, the administration and the police took the benefit of that. There was a discussion one night about putting dynamite in the elevator shaft. That was presented to a gentleman who, it turned out, was a plant.
Right.
Had we accepted that, they sort of moved in at that point and the rest of it was.
Black, thick smoke. And I remember we were panicking because it was coming all over. And it was so dark that we had to crawl on the floor to get out of the back. The door was locked from the outside. And we were banging and banging and banging. The only reason I'm still here and the other students is because somebody found a fire axe, and we literally had to break the door to get out, at which point the police was there, and they took us to... They took us to the classrooms are on the side. The windows were open because there was smoke. I don't know who broke them. It wasn't us because we weren't anywhere near those classrooms. And they separated the group. I don't remember if it was the first room or the second, whatever. And we had to stand like this for 3 hours. And anybody who lowered their hand like this got beaten from the back. Women, I got banged, my contact went up here, right contact, I still remember. I wasn't allowed to move my hands. There were young girls that were taken, like one in particular, like a chicken, and paraded around the room. That whenever they didn't have any badges, and whenever cameras or whatever, they would stop hitting everybody. Then when we went down after 3 hours of literally freezing in the garage, which had never been, that's where they all were. And in the elevator, most people got beaten. And I don't mean like a little, I mean beaten, which I, at that time I was very young, and I found the police was to protect us. Then they put us in paddy wagons, which they drove when we came out, while people were yelling, burn, I won't even say the word. They drove until we got to the downtown jail, like this. I know I put the heat on, I mean, I'll spare you. And I turned 20 in jail on February the 25th, and we were denied bail. Today you kill somebody, you're out within an hour. And we were denied bail the first time. The second time they brought us back, because we were at Tangay, it was real, you know, real. All the streets were blocked, and that was the first time that I realized, wow, this is me, because I had never seen pictures or anybody with the computer cards, or I had never seen any of that, and neither did the rest. So it's been a very strange experience for me, because I've never talked about this. I want you to know that at the time, I considered a badge of honor, but it took more than 25 years. I have never talked to anybody, because you could be fired. You're ostracized. All my friends, dear high school friends, would walk the other way. And I only mentioned it when I became director of students at Dawson, because Dawson was, and it's, you're talking 1980-98, okay? Because it's important to remember that it really destroyed the one.
When, on February 11th, when we were in the computer center, when the doors were locked, when the riot squad was called in, unbeknownst to us, and we had to react to all of this, people started to amass outside of the university. People who were coming to the university to do what they normally did, but they couldn't get in now because the police had sealed it all off. We could look out the window, but the window's open, remember? The window's open. And being that we were in the computer center, one of the things we did, so people would know we were alive, is that we threw out all of the computer cards that were used at the time, because now we're using chips, whatever. But at the time, they were cards. So it was raining computer cards. And we could look out, and there, while there were a lot of police, and some of the pictures around you'll see, there were a lot of students. And then there were just, in general, a lot of people. People like Yvonne were coming back and finding this stuff out, rushed over to the university. And then we would hear, oh, there's a contingent coming from McGill University to support us. These were very important moments as we were in that computer center, you know, frightened, because most of us were, you know, we had never been in a situation that had anything to do with the police at any level. So it was rather, you know, frightening. And so when we saw the McGill students, and we saw some of our friends who would have been inside if not for, you know, the night before this happened, because we had heard it was over, and as Michelle said, we were cleaning up, there would have been many, many more people if it was the day before or 2 days before. I myself wouldn't have been there, because I used to come every day. I wasn't a student. I would come every day and leave every night. But that night I stayed to help with the goings-on overnight. So it became this odd group of people. So there were many of our friends who wished they had been inside, that were outside, that gave their all to supporting us, which was so important at that moment in time. And I must tell you a side story, the best for me. When we were in prison, we used to get the papers. They let us get the newspapers. And it was either the next day or 2 days later, they had these demonstrations in front of the courthouse. And I saw a woman holding up a sign, "Free the students," and it was my mother. And I was so proud and happy. And it was very meaningful at that moment. At least I knew my mother wasn't mad. At least it didn't show.
Cinema Politico Concordia is thrilled to be hosting the Quebec premiere, Everything Must Fall, on February 11th. Everything Must Fall follows the fight for decolonized and affordable education in South Africa, as it takes an unflinching look at the 2015 hashtag Fees Must Fall student movement, which became the most militant national revolt since the country's first democratic elections in 1994. This award-winning documentary is part of the Protests and Pedagogy Conference at Concordia. The screening of Everything Must Fall will take place in Concordia's Hall Building on Monday, February 11th at 7 p.m. For more information, go to cinemapolitica.org. We hope to see you there!
Welcome back to CKUT 90.3 FM in Montreal. This is Tops with Ways to Be Loved. The time now is 5:57. That is all we have for today, folks. Thanks for tuning in. Please tune in again next week when we have Canadian icon and Indigenous activist Buffy St. Marie on the show. We also have a special interview about unions and labor on campus.
Is that the way that you are? I can picture you staring out the window. Go by, oh, the nights go by. Is that the way that you are? I can picture you staring out the window, not caring. The nights go by, oh, the nights go by. Staring out the window, not caring.